street epistemology is a wonderful approach that anyone can learn. You can learn more about street epistemology at streetepistemology.com.
Thanks, FK. Hello, everyone. What's up? I guess we'll have to do with that. Let me, yes, I can see the chat now. Cool. This is my fifth AMA, and I don't know if I should keep doing these or not. I guess as long as people keep showing up, I'll keep doing them. This is your chance to ask me questions about street epistemology, or I don't know. Someone was asking me about free will the other time I did this. If you are not comfortable coming up on the stage, you can go ahead and put your question in the text. Preface it with a question mark, like put the question mark at the start, and then I will read it. But if you want to come up on stage, I think you could raise your hand. Oh, I do see some. Okay, there's no request yet there. Okay. Oh, good. This interface is easier to use than before. Oh, thanks for showing up. This is really impressive. Steel Fox, I'm still pretty new to Discord. Can you listen without joining the stage, or is this just like a hangout? It's just like a hangout. You should just be able to hear me. And if somebody comes up on the stage, you should be able to hear us both. And looks like I'm recording at least the audio. And I think I'm screen capturing the video. Steel Fox, I think I saw your introduction. Have you helped test some of the modules in the course? Okay, here's a question. Well, Steel Fox typing, maybe. Okay. Are you familiar with the new types of street epistemology coming out of the community? I think so. If you're referring to the compassionate epistemology offshoot, of which there's a Discord server at the very least, what does it mean to have a new type of it? Does it require more than a community of people doing it or interested in it? Maybe that's all you need. Okay, you didn't help in the channel testing. Thanks. But I am familiar with an offshoot. I guess I would call it an offshoot called compassionate epistemology, where they put a greater emphasis on nonviolent communication, which I'm really excited about that because NVC and empathy are a really big component, I think, to helping people feel safe, psychologically safe, so that you can actually use the tools of SE to get down into the deeper levels on which their beliefs and confidences are based on. And it's probably a good thing for the practitioner to be aware of it as well. The expression of feelings and needs. Love it. Are there other types? I wonder if you're referring to spectrum street epistemology there. There's also meditative epistemology and mapping SE. I didn't even hear these terms yet. Huh. Wow. I have not heard of those, but I'm excited about offshoots of it. I always suspected that we would start seeing stuff like that when we hit, I don't know, what's the breaking point? It's probably not just population, but differences of opinion of as to what's important when it comes to SE, maybe. Maybe that's what's driving it. I would imagine that there might be offshoot communities who think empathy and informed consent are not necessary, that you should go as hard and as strong as you possibly can to get down to the foundation of a person's reason, regardless of the consequences. So we'll see where all this goes. But what an interesting development. Here we are 11 years after Boghossian's first book came out, and we're seeing offshoots of it. I think it's healthy. I think it's good. And we probably should be open-minded to what those groups are doing. So if you just joined, you can go ahead and raise your hand and I'll add you to the stage, possibly. And if you're uncomfortable with that, just go ahead and type in your question. Put the question mark before your question, before and after. Kind of like Spanish, but you don't have to invert the first question. Yeah, the SE survey is a great one. What was the first offshoot of SE? I mean, you could argue that the SE that was in the book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, was the first version of it, and then there were different iterations that came up for that. Have you worked with Dr. Marshall Rosenberg? If not, would you? A collaboration would be epic. Is he still alive? I mean, I know the answer to your question is no. I think I would like to. Yeah, he's not alive. I'd be interested in working with him or other people. In fact, there was I think there's an NVC community on Facebook, or maybe it's a motivational interviewing one. Yeah, okay, he passed away in 2015. So no, I haven't worked with him. And even prior to that, I haven't. I made a comment in the motivational interviewing Facebook group, one of them, asking people if they were aware of street epistemology, and it was crickets back. Now, this was 4 or 5 years ago, and I probably made similar posts in the NBC one. You know what? I think I've reached out to the executive director of the nonviolent communication organization, introducing myself and telling them about what SE was. This was on LinkedIn maybe a year ago. And crickets, didn't hear anything back. So no, I have not. What would a collaboration look like with somebody from NVC? It's probably similar to what we're seeing in the offshoot community for the compassionate epistemology. If somebody wants to share the invite to that server, is that allowed? It should be allowed, right? Raise your hand if you want to come up. Otherwise, just fire questions at me in the chat. There's no hands up. I guess I'll vamp a little bit. Is Nathan in here? Nathan gave me some great advice, abstract activist. So I'm giving a talk. I'll drop the link in the chat. I'm going to be giving a talk to Plato's Academy. There's a philosophy for children program that I was invited to speak at. I only have 20 minutes, and you can sign up there. I think it's free. You can make a donation if you want to. It's a great organization. And as I understand it, they have 300 to 500 teachers who will be showing up at this thing so that they can learn about various aspects of philosophy and then take those learnings back to their students. So I was a little stymied. I knew that I wanted to teach concepts from street epistemology to those teachers so that they can teach their students. I mean, think of the efficiency there. If I can reach 300 to 500 teachers who can then reach thousands of students, what an amazing thing that would be for street epistemology. So what I decided to do was put together I have five things that we've discovered when you use SE, and these tend to surface in the SE survey. So for example, the idea of the map versus territory, or truth versus opinion. These are my five. I'll go from here. Truth valuation, the real reason check, and then tests with passes and fails. So what I want to do is teach teachers what they can teach their students. And these will be centered around the things that we tend to notice when we're doing SE. These are the resistance. These are the barriers. These are the points of confusion that we notice in our conversation partners and ourselves when we're doing SE. So now we can be proactive and teach teachers about this, and they can teach their students. So that's what I'm doing. But anyways, Nathan suggested, and maybe he has a teaching background or something, I don't know. It's not Nate, but Nathan Ferguson. He was saying that you can make your talk more interesting if you focus on problems that teachers and students are generally facing. So with that in mind, I use ChatGPT and I built out this really cool outline. Okay, let's get back to the questions here. Sorry. What drove you to do this? An event? A person? I don't know what you mean exactly by this. Like this AMA? Or generating SE content? So Kyle, maybe just quickly reply to that. Okay. You haven't typed back yet. Oh, Kyle's typing. Okay. SE work. What drove you to do this? The thing that drove me first was reading Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, and recognizing that it could be useful for having better conversations with my loved ones and friends about religion. And in the book, there were a couple of short text examples of dialogues, but nothing else. And I wanted to see examples. So I went out and just started creating them with people here in San Antonio. And that was the genesis of my YouTube channel. And then recognizing the utility of SE and the potential impact it's going to have, I think, on society and human flourishing. So it kind of sucked me in. Nir, not sure if you've touched on this already, but where do you see SE headed a few years ago, and where do you see it headed now? Has your conception of where it's going changed? No, my conception of where SE is going, or like will eventually go, probably hasn't changed much in the last 10 years. Now, the manner with which we get there has changed. So I'm less convinced uploading videos and doing review shows of SE videos per se is the most effective way to reach a broader audience. It's good. It's helpful. You got to see examples. Nothing sells SE better than actually seeing it happen. But as far as normalizing it and getting it out into the culture, it may not be the best way to do it. Right? Like a 30-minute video where you watch people like slowly talking about things and then, oh, you get a moment of reflection. It's kind of boring. So the method for achieving those goals has changed. Like, for example, today, paid coaching and training is on the radar. Bringing these tools to businesses so that they can teach their employees how to make better decisions at work, that type of thing. So, yeah. Feel free to join on the stage if you want. Otherwise, I'll just keep taking the questions here, which are awesome, in the text. Okay. Jan says, unfortunately, I can't raise my hand. Why not? What are your thoughts on the recent SSE content from Peter Boghossian? Recent. I don't really watch a lot of his stuff, and I don't generally watch a lot of SE content in general, but the little bit that I've seen on video, and then it's been about 3 months now where I saw that Peter was doing, he was invited to do street epistemology at a conference in Santa Barbara. So I bought a plane ticket and a ticket to the event. I flew out there. I showed up right as he was doing his SSE. I sat in the back and I really didn't want to throw him off. I listened to it. And when he was done, I went right back to the airport. Because I wanted to see firsthand, like, what's going on here? So what are my thoughts about it? I think the jury is still out on spectrum street epistemology, to be honest. I think that there could be some utility to exploring beliefs in that way. But from what I've seen firsthand, sitting in an audience there, and then the videos, is that it seems to me that most of the questions center around the what. What is it that you believe, and what is your terminology? It's very Socratic method-y, with not a lot of exploring the quality of reasons and methods. And maybe I've had conversations with Reed about this, because Reed works with Peter in these instances, and he was there too. Pete was on the stage, and Reed was literally like throwing questions up for Pete to ask the audience, which I thought was a little strange. But apparently the questions that Reed is serving up are meant to highlight and get down to foundational stuff. But I'm just not seeing it yet. So from what I've seen so far, I'm not crazy about it, because it seems like it's just simply platforming ideas and claims. And then you reset and you platform more ideas and claims. And why would you want to do that if you have a better tool that can actually help people reflect on the quality of their reasoning? And I don't tend to see that, especially with the competitive nature where you have two people up there. And sometimes one of the persons, or maybe two, I've seen like two or three people on a scale, or on that spectrum thing. And some of them, I get the impression that they're they're friends of the person facilitating it. Or at the very least, the facilitator might know where one person on that spectrum stands, but the other person on the spectrum is not aware of it. So that doesn't seem very fair or balanced. So generally, I guess in short, I'm not really crazy about it, but I think that there's a lot of potential for it. And here's one thing that they could try. I think I may even pass this along to Reed. It generally starts off with asking a question. They say go, and then people move to a spot, and then they hit them with like 10 more questions that seem claim-based. It would be interesting if they resurface the original question that they posed to the participants to see if they arrive back at the same spots that they started at, or if there was some shifting. That would help increase my confidence in the utility of it, if there was some reflection and moving. And I don't know why you can't raise your hand, Jan. That's weird. Oh, there's somebody who wants to come up. Oh, let me grab this one. Oh, Jan. Jan, okay. Did I just answer your question, though? Let me take the next one, and then I'll get back to you if you're still on the stage. All right. The interviews of yours that I've watched are primarily conducted in an environment such as college or urban demographic. Do you have any advice for how to use SE with a demographic that is anti-intellectual and unaccustomed to exploring ideas? Where the heck is that at? Like the mall or something? You know, it's funny. My son was here on spring break like 2 weeks ago, and we went to a bowling alley. And I don't know, post-COVID, I'm not really crazy about like really large, like noisy environments. Maybe that's besides the point. But I don't know. I was looking around, and people were enjoying themselves and eating and drinking and living life and probably not giving a lot of thought to the beliefs that they've acquired. Now, whether or not you would call that anti-intellectual or not, I don't know. They're probably people that are way smarter than me in there. I don't know if I call it anti-intellectual. It's that people are probably just really busy working and paying the bills and trying to put food on the table, where they don't have the luxury of being able to think about their thoughts that much. Or maybe they're not actually given the opportunity to do that. It's probably more of that than anti-intellectual. What would an anti-intellectual place look like? I don't even know. What does that look like? I can't think of some now, actually. I don't know why this didn't come to mind. When I was first starting street epistemology, I went to the Alamo to talk to the street preachers. And they were anti-intellectual. Like, I think at one point I mentioned critical thinking, and like two of the preachers just started laughing. Like they felt they've been conditioned to think that critical thinking was like a humorous thing. So that was a little disturbing. So yeah, maybe that's probably the best that I can do for like an anti-intellectual environment where you're discouraged from doubting and questioning. And this reminds me of that interview that I did with the young student named Marin. Maybe somebody could drop the link to that. I think the video is called Doubt is of the Devil. So he was raised in an environment where you don't question things. There's certain things that you don't question. And rather than question his belief about a higher power, we had a discussion about questioning in general and what might be the advantages of doubt. Okay, Jan, are you still there? Come on up, Jan.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for doing the AMA, and thanks for answering the question about Peter Boghossian's content. You mentioned something about you having the impression that people are on the spectrum who are friends. What's your where does this impression come from?
I think I remember watching a video where Nathan Ormond was in London with Peter and was it Billboard Chris or somebody, and they were doing some SE. I think in that case, Peter was familiar with both people, but I don't know. Have there been examples? I think there have been a few examples where One of the people on the scale of the spectrum was familiar with Peter's work, and other people were not. And I don't know if that gives people an advantage or not. That's all I'm saying. Because I think in the case of Billboard Chris and Nathan, the facilitator was familiar with both of them, maybe to different degrees. That's all I meant there.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I'll hold this.
Okay. He'll be back. Ragnar says there might be some issue with people being able to raise their hand. That's no problem. You just put your question in the chat if you want. Okay. Argana asks, any thoughts about Thomas Gordon and leadership effectiveness training? He talks a lot about active listening and conversation blocks. I'm unfamiliar with Thomas Gordon or leadership effectiveness training. So sorry, I can't answer that. Okay. Sounds interesting, though. I was invited to give a presentation to a large multinational corporation who was considering doing street epistemology training. And it was a Zoom call with like a whole bunch of executives. It was kind of intimidating. And one of the people said, how is SE any different than coaching? And that kind of gave me some pause, like, oh, that's interesting. And I can't remember what I came up with. I thought my answer was pretty decent, but there's probably a better answer to give to that. I think that there is. And Thomas Gordon, leadership effectiveness training, makes me wonder if it's similar to that. You're going to notice a lot of overlap with the tools. Like active listening is such a great tool for other things. I'm not surprised that it might show up in other things, including SE. You have to keep in mind that SE started with this idea from Peter's book. People started grabbing it and going out there. And then we started looking for ideas on how to make it better. So people just started throwing things at SE communities. And then practitioners started adopting it and testing it out and seeing what worked and didn't. If something didn't work, we got rid of it. Like the timer is probably a good example. Why would you want to put a time pressure component on somebody when you want to help them reflect on things? So things come and go. Okay, Ragnar says that the raising hand issue is fixed now, and he's inviting Jan to go ahead and raise their hand. The military is an anti-intellectual space. You're discouraged from questioning. Yeah, maybe so. This reminds me, in San Antonio, Texas, what is the name of the base? There's an Air Force base here in town. There were several of them, but when I moved here 20 years ago, they started shutting them down. I think there's just a couple in here now. And there are some secular organizations that go there on a weekly basis. I don't know if they still do this. And they bring speakers in. And they wanted to have a secular offering to the cadets to complement all the religious ones that were out there. And they got a little bit of pushback from the higher-ups to do that, but they eventually did. And they talked about inviting me to give a talk there, but I never did. So what does that mean? I don't know. It was probably just a scheduling thing. But I would love to see more Socratic questioning and street epistemology in that type of environment. It reminds me of the scout versus soldier mindset. And I was just writing this for my talk that I mentioned earlier. Remember this, the Julia Galef, the scout mindset? Galef contrasts the scout mindset with the soldier mindset, where the soldier mindset is about defending one's views against evidence that might contradict them. The scout mindset is characterized by curiosity, open-mindedness, and a readiness to update one's beliefs based on new information and evidence. I'm not taking it literally because they're soldiers, but maybe there's that mentality of sort of digging in and fighting for your position and being confident in what you think is true. And then we're confident and fearful, possibly, you are in the things that you make. You move up in the ranks. Is that what happens there? I would think probably that's it. There's probably an incentive to be dogmatically certain in the military. Thanks for posting the link to the video. Sushi says, people that straight up don't care about progressing the conversation beyond the claim. When they don't want to explore, they are just correct. That must have been a comment to maybe something that I said earlier. And I'm wondering if you're talking about the practitioner who's doing SE or the claimant. You're probably talking about the SEer. Yeah. When you just reside at the what level about the claim and the benefits the claim is and the nuances of the claim, that's okay, you can do that, but what are you actually achieving? You're probably not helping them reflect on their reasoning. You're just, I don't know what you're doing there. So, and that does, maybe that was a reference to the SSE stuff. Yeah. Jake, what's up, Jake? In what ways do you think journalists can incorporate the techniques of street epistemology into their interviews to encourage more thoughtful and reflective discussions on political issues? I would love to see more journalists doing Socratic street epistemology types of questions. Even the recent one with Don Lemon and Elon Musk. Did you see any of that? Like, Don was asking good questions, but he was encountering defensiveness. And if he just tweaked his questions a little bit and was more charitable in the framing of them and doing some active listening, Elon probably would have answered them. So Don shot himself in the foot quite a bit. He made some good points, and I think he exposed some faulty thinking and maybe an unpreparedness of Elon in that instance, but it could have gone much deeper and much more profound if Don had adopted some street epistemology techniques, I think. Don, give me a call. What challenges might arise when applying street epistemology to political beliefs, which are often deeply entrenched and emotionally charged? How might these challenges be navigated? Political beliefs are so interesting because they almost seem more tied to our identity and tribal affiliation than religion. But ironically, is it ironically the right word? At the heart of the political beliefs, I think, are where people stand on God claims. So that's not a hard and fast rule, because we can point to people who used to believe in a higher power and were, let's say that they were very right-leaning, and then they became an atheist and they're still right-leaning. So it's not like they're tied together that much. What challenges might arise when applying? I don't know. It's probably not all that different than any other belief. A political belief is very tied to a person's identity. You're going to encounter defensiveness if you provide facts or you try to show that you're right and they're wrong or something along those lines. But we are really politicized these days. Okay, I'll move on. I don't really have a good answer for you on that one, I think. Are there any hands up? No. Can a narcissistic person change and apply a new way of behaving and interacting? I think that is possible for a narcissist or somebody who has a big ego. They can do it, but it takes a lot of time and practice. And maybe one thing that those people could do is merely recognizing when there are certain claims that their egos get tripped up on and just putting a pin in it and just, I don't know what they would do. Set that belief aside and explore other beliefs and get practiced in exploring the deeper levels of beliefs. And noticing when they're getting upset and making a note of what was said that upset them, and then think about it And if they do that enough, they could probably start inching back towards those other beliefs that are very triggering to them. A person's personality is such a big factor when you do SE, and how do you change your personality? Like, you might have to encounter somebody that you really admire, and you see growth, or you aspire to be that person. We change our personalities gradually over time, don't we? So yeah, maybe even a narcissistic person could change. There's got to be some cutoff, though. At some level, their brains just maybe can't do it. Was Reed stepping down discussed? Nobody brought that up yet, but we did an announcement yesterday. Reed was the president of SEI, and he stepped down as the board. We've been working on this for months, and it finally resulted in him stepping down. He's still on the board of directors, and he can still vote and do all that other stuff. Much of his work with SEI won't change. It's a change by title, and it's a good one too, I think. I think everyone on the board, probably even including Reed, would say that it's probably a good thing. And we have a town hall coming up. So if you want to get more into the details of that with Reed in the room and the rest of the board, or most of the people from the board, you can join this community town hall right there. And that loses my place, unfortunately, when I made that post. Okay. Yeah, I think I'd rather talk more about that. That's a big deal, right? Like, what's going on there? We could probably get more into that at the town hall. Nir says, you mentioned your kids earlier. What do they think about SE? And what do you think about the way they examine their own and others' beliefs? I have two kids, and my daughter is here on spring break now, and she, 10 minutes before this live stream, she was excited because she's got two interviews with she graduates in June, so she's lining up like postgraduate internships, and I think she got an offer for both, for each of those. What do they think about SE? My daughter, I think, understands it pretty good. She signed up for the mailing list. She mentioned that she whenever I send out a mailing list, she'll usually message me to say that she received it. Whenever I send out like an update through the mailing list, she'll message me. I think she's leaning towards teaching and probably teaching young people. And she was sharing with me some projects she was working on for her graduation, or for, you know, whatever, her last term. And she picked the claim birds are not real as like a vehicle for teaching students about birds. So she was approaching it from a point of common skepticism that we see in the culture, but kind of jokingly, to get the kids' attention, and then switch to teaching how you can identify different types of birds. And I thought that was really cool. Is that related to SE? I don't know. She's aware of it. I think she even does it. She's in one of Peter's videos on the campus. Reed had mentioned that they were on this campus, and I messaged her. I think I said something like, hey, you know, they're going to be out there doing some SE talks. Don't get roped into anything. If they ask you to volunteer, flag students down, don't do that. But just go ahead and say hi. And the next thing I know, she was messaging me, and she did two Spectrum SEs. And she was like, oh, man. This one student got so mad. And then my son is interesting. He's a sophomore at Arizona State University. And there is a street preacher, a young guy, who frequents that campus quite a bit. And he's a guy that I've interviewed before 6 or 7 years ago. And my son has reported that he's had some conversations with him. He waits till he's done yelling at all the students, and that kind of thing settle down, and then he'll talk with them a little bit. That's pretty cool to see. When interviewing outside, what's the best way to get people to stop and do the SE talk in the first place? Usually people pass by in groups or with somewhere to go or are with children, and it discourages them from stopping to talk. Yeah, I hardly ever will ask anyone in a group. unless it's two people, if they want to stop. Yeah, if they have children, I don't ask. What would be a good kind of phrase on a sign that would make them curious? The most common one I see these days is, what do you believe and why? Which is pretty good. I gave a talk to the Secular Student Alliance. What is it called? It's something like perfectly positioned, the Secular Student Alliance. And in the video description, I have a whole bunch of questions that I thought would be good for the SSA, but it would be applicable here too, of questions that you could ask that, even if it didn't result in them stopping to speak with you, they might read the question and ponder it as they're walking to their class or they're walking by. So if somebody feels adventurous, maybe you can find that video and drop in the questions in the chat. That might be fun to see those. But when you are interviewing outside, I found that there's an ideal mix of foot traffic. So if you have very few people walking by, you get very few people that will stop, because I'm guessing people feel a little bit alone and unsafe. And if you have too many people stopping by or walking by, hardly anybody stops, because I think that they think that they could just ignore you because so many other people are ignoring you. But if you get just that right mix of people walking by, and people feel safe, and there's people around, but not too many people around, then you get a lot of good. The likelihood of people stopping to talk with you goes up. I think I would even say that it's not even necessary to have a sign. That is not necessary. Is it Two Day David has a cardboard cutout of himself? He uses something to kind of catch people's attention. So you're talking about like outdoor street epistemology. Yeah. The key thing there is to just appear safe, because, you know, no one wants to have a big ordeal or an encounter with a stranger in the woods or on a campus or something like that. So just carry yourself well, be friendly, and just don't be a jerk and people will stop and talk with you. Randolph Air Force Base. Yeah, maybe that was it. What kind of literature review did you do for adjacent ideas to SE? Intellectual coaching takes not only the form of Socratic dialogue, but in certain design and red teaming methods. Do you think it might be useful to document these adjacent activities? Oh, and Lackland. I think it's Lackland. I think they closed Randolph down. Literature review for... I don't do a lot of reading personally, but I know that there are people in SE communities who do, and then they make recommendations based off of things that they've read. And then I might overhear that or read it and think, well, that's interesting. Maybe I'll give that a try. And then it's sort of what's working and what's not. So, yeah, I don't do a lot of reading per se. I find it very hard to concentrate and read these days. Now, with regards to the course, it's kind of interesting too. We're developing the course called Navigating Beliefs. And we're basically outlining what we understand to be the case. And then we internally test it with a team. And then we externally test it with volunteers. And then we draft it. And again, then we write it. And then we look to see what we wrote. And we look for things. Like, we look for references to what we wrote to back up what we've written, because it seems like it's the case. And very often we do find references to that. That's probably a terrible thing to admit, but I mean, that's kind of how we've been doing it. So a lot of what we're doing with the development of the course is coming from our own experiences and 10 years of interacting with the community and then developing it. And then there seems to be a need for people who read this stuff to want to have other things to read to that back up what we just said. You'll notice that there are not a lot of endnotes in the course. A lot of it is just coming off of as we've seen it from our experiences. Oh, there's a hand up. Okay, sorry to keep you waiting. Samira, come on up.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, hi.
I have a question. So how would you approach a conversation with someone that is kind of, I wouldn't say opposed, but kind of suspicious of SE, and they think it's like a cross-examination type thing? Obviously, you don't want to have a conversation without the consent of the other person, but I really want to have a conversation with this person. So it's a bit difficult. So what advice would you give for that?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, if somebody says, I don't like it, or it looks like an interrogation, you're cross-examining people, I wouldn't just say, well, don't worry about that. Let's keep exploring your belief using SE. You have to address it. Much like if they were being hostile, you might want to switch to something like nonviolent communication. In that instance, I would set the claims aside, or the claims that I wanted to explore with them, and instead use similar types of questioning to understand what it is they don't like about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because we ask too many questions? Would you like to see, what would you like to see that would make you more open to actually doing an SE talk? The ironic thing here is that in order to do that with them, to find out what they don't like about it, is you end up kind of using SE tools. So, but I would say, like, hover more at the understanding level rather than the helping them reflect, and definitely not like persuading them or challenging them too much. I would really try to understand.
Yeah, I'm just the person usually doesn't even want to start the conversation. So it's, yeah, maybe I can ask why.
SE won't work if your conversation partner doesn't want to do it with you. So then the only other option you have is to explore why they would be reluctant to do it. You know, what would you need to see in order to do it? What is it that you don't like about it? How about if I try it and at any point you don't like what I'm doing, you stop me and then we explore what it is you didn't like about it. And another thing is can be really helpful there too, is explaining it as you go. And I think we cover this in module 6 of the course, where you can say, how about if I give you a heads up as to why I want to ask you this question or do this thing? Would that be helpful? And if they still give you some resistance, you can say, okay, well, what is your preferred method? Like, I have a claim. What would you use to explore my reasoning behind that claim? And then see what they do. And I'd be really curious to see what they would find better.
I think that person specifically is very much into those debatey type of conversations. And I want to avoid that. But I think your advice on it is pretty good. So thank you. Okay.
And one last thing before you go would be like, what are their goals? What are they hoping to achieve from doing that with their conversation partner? Like, when you debate, what are you hoping to, what would be the ideal result when you do that? And then you can say, would you like to know what my ideal result would be if I were to explore your beliefs? And then you can compare and contrast. Okay. Anything else?
For me?
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming up. You were the first, second brave one to come up. Okay.
Do I have to leave the stage too?
I don't know how to. Oh, yeah, there was a move to audience button right at the top. I missed it. All right. If SE was an animal, what animal would you pick? Oh, that's obvious, isn't it? I would say a duck. At least it is for me. You're calm on the surface and you're paddling furiously underneath to figure out the next best question. Okay. Ragnar, you typed something, but it's way too long. So I don't know if I should read. And there's a question mark there. Okay. I feel like the SE practitioner just clarifying a claim as end goal can be perceived by the claimant as a take, because the claimant could perceive never being understood on a deeper level. What value would the claimant receive if they are just constantly explaining themselves to the SE practitioner to bring them up to speed? Sure, there is a basic need to understand the claimant to move on, but examining every aspect of the claim seems counterproductive. I think I agree with you. And this goes back to maybe my main complaint or concern about SSE as we see it today. Like, I don't know. I want more than just to understand your position on it. I want to understand how you can be so sure that that's true. Is this related to what you're saying? Yeah, you don't have to examine every basic need to understand the claim. Sometimes I think maybe there's a reluctance of SE practitioners, maybe newbies, to move off of the what types of questions about the belief itself into more challenging questions about reasons and methods. So I would be frustrated maybe as a claimant if that was done to me. And I don't know if you're hinting at this or not. You're talking about the origin of the claim. Yeah. The origin of the claim is not all that interesting to me. It's helpful. It's a good icebreaker. It's good for rapport, but I wouldn't dwell there. Okay. What's the worst accusation you've heard against SE? I can imagine people saying it was gaslighting. I've heard that. Gaslighting Snake Hunt is a video on my channel. A guy accused me of gaslighting him or maybe the students by me out there asking questions. I can imagine people saying it was gaslighting or similar, causing them to reconsider things they took as reality. Well, how would you mitigate this? Not at all suggesting that it is, but considering possible reactions. This is nuanced, because in a way you are asking people to take another look at their reasoning methods, which does have implications for how they're viewing reality. But that's usually an outcome, that's usually a potential outcome, I should say, but it's not the objective, I don't think. Generally people who might call it gaslighting or that's probably the worst thing that I think I've heard it called. This reminds me of the previous question where you get resistance to even wanting to do it. If somebody thinks that you're gaslighting, then you need to explore what they mean by the word. Can you point to a specific example where I said or did something where it appeared that I was doing, that I was gaslighting? Because I don't want to do that. That sounds terrible. I wouldn't want it done to me. So taking a step back and going meta, going broad, and exploring the actual concern that they have is probably the way to go. Okay. I think Bagosian's new stuff is focused on getting people to listen to people they disagree with, as opposed to assuming strawman arguments they've heard. That's a good point. I tend to see that a little bit, especially now that they're asking questions such as, what is it? They give them a whiteboard and they say, can you write down the argument that you think the person has for their position? Is that what they do? Or maybe they do a variation where they say, Can you write down what you think they would say your argument is? Do they do a variation of that? Like, that's all good and that's healthy. I like that. But taking yourself out of your belief set and entertaining somebody else's is really healthy. So if that's what they're doing, I think that's useful. Oh, there's a couple more hands. Okay, Bjorn. What's up, Bjorn? I think you're muted.
Yes, we were. Hello, hello.
Oh. Hi, hi. Red light.
Hello.
Great to see you.
So, what's up? Yeah, I'm good. And you?
Pretty good.
So I wanted to ask, because I get a little SE from the side, from Bjorn.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. I was wondering, how can you discuss SE or tap into the ability of children to, well, be open-minded people and get to be critical thinkers, or, you know, how they develop in all sorts of ways, but how can you tap into SE with them, or have a conversation about SE with them, and not SE as, you know, SE, but
use it, maybe.
Yeah, maybe use it.
Okay. Well, I think probably kids generally have that sense of curiosity already.
Mm-hmm.
Many times I've noticed this even in my own family, my extended family. Like, the kid would say something or do something, and the parent would just shut down their curiosity. Like, the kid was going up these stairs, and they said, "Don't go up there. There's a monster up there." Like, I don't know. Like, that seemed counterproductive to do that. So there's probably things that we do as parents that shut down their curiosity right from the start, whether we realize it or not. It's probably also listening to them. What are their fears? Are they afraid to go to bed because they do think that there's a monster under the bed?
Mm.
And exploring their reasoning with them at the level that they're capable of would be good. And they're also going to probably be coming to you with problems. You know, so-and-so at school said this thing, and I'm so angry at them, and they're wrong. And it might be just a matter of, like, recognizing those moments and modeling really good, curious, constructive behavior to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's terrible. I wonder what might be going through their mind where they would do or say something like that. Coming from a place of wonder and sharing your wonder with them, I think, could be infectious. And that's what we've done with our kids growing up. You know, we've had the most amazing conversations. They used to go to daycare. So I'd drop them off at daycare, and we spent, you know, 30 minutes in the car. This is America, by the way. So, like, 30 minutes in Texas too, 30 minutes in the car to get there, another 45 minutes back home with traffic at the end of the day. And we would just have great talks. And that's probably, I wouldn't force it on them, though. I would just, you kind of have to play the long game and just wait for the opportunities to come up.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you doing? Have you found anything that you found helpful or not helpful in your own attempts?
Well, we like to see our how we raise our kids by being curious and asking questions and walk with them down the lane to exploring their feelings and exploring their thoughts. So I can really relate to that. And I'm actually in a kind of a management team of a big daycare center. So we have for about 10,000 kids. And I was kind of wondering if there's a method that we could explore. But we also have in our vision that we have an open mind and be curious and that sort of thing. And be responsive to children and what they give you. So what you're saying is really relating to me. So, yeah, I think we're kind of on the same page, but I was wondering if there's a kind of a method to you know, enable children who are locked down.
Stimulate,
yeah.
I think it really comes down to picking the right time and not dwelling on it too much.
Yeah.
So an opportunity comes up, you recognize that, oh, this would be a great question to explore with them. You broach, see if they're, you know, are they in the right mindset for this type of conversation? Pose the question, get a response, maybe talk about it a little bit. If they're losing interest, then you just let it go. As you were talking, though, you reminded me of something else that I've seen, especially in Texas or the Southern culture in the United States. There's also a tendency to teach kids to be deferential to adults, which of course is good, but oftentimes I think it's too excessive, where kids just instinctively say, yes, sir, no, sir. And they defer to the authority of the adult here, much more so than I feel comfortable. I notice it quite a bit in a lot of families. And that could be problematic too, where you're teaching kids to basically believe adults because of their age, I guess.
Yeah.
So sometimes culturally we do things that we don't even think about are problematic to the critical thinking skills and the types of skills that you would want to have your kids have.
Yeah, so parents are always right and parents are perfect, or adults are always right. And yeah.
They confuse respect with accuracy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks.
You're very welcome. It was nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Bjorn's better half. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Much better half.
All right. Well, we really appreciate all that Bjorn's done. And I'm sure he's been pulled away from lots of things. He's very dedicated to helping us out.
Yeah, nice, great.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, it's great. He loves it.
Okay, good. I hope so.
Cool.
All right, folks. Well, thanks. Do you have anything else?
Thank you. Well, loads, but not for now. No, thanks.
Loads, okay. All right. Great talking to you.
You too. Thanks.
Okay, Jake, come on up. And we're coming up on an hour, and I'll probably just go an hour and a half total. So another 35 more minutes. Jake, what's up? Jake. Oh, I think you're muted.
Great. Am I loud and clear?
Loud and clear.
Great. Hey, it's really great to see you. Thank you so much for hosting this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had just a couple of questions here. One of them I already put in the chat, and another one's actually a follow-up from Bjorn's question about SE with children. So I think it might be best to maybe start with that, just to segue. I was really curious about, now I'm in an opportunity where my sister, she offered me the opportunity to tutor my nephew, which I'm really excited about. But also my sister has some kind of strange beliefs, and those have been injected into my nephew. And so I'm driving in the car with him, and for some reason he tells me that the earth is flat. He's a little 5-year-old and like, cowboy. And I'm sure that he got it from his mother. I asked him a couple of questions, like how he knows that. And it was because his mother told him, and I asked him if everything was always right. And he just kind of just shut up and didn't really want to talk much after that.
That. That's interesting. Huh.
Yeah. So I was really curious about how to approach that, because I'm wanting to have kind of I'm definitely wanting to address that. At the same time, it's kind of strange because my sister, she's wanting me to not impose certain perspectives. And as strange as that is, I love astronomy. I love science and knowing how things work. And it's so I'm in this situation where I'm needing to teach him sort of how to think and how to think critically about these things. So I'm curious how to bring that up with him so that I can get his gears starting to move, get him thinking about this, if he really has good reasons to think what he thinks on that.
I mean, my assessment would be that you know what you could ask to generate that type of critical reflection in him, but the barriers might be coming from his parents. Like, if he was reluctant to even entertain that question, it's possible that he may have been warned, like, now Uncle Jake asked these questions, and if he does, you don't have to answer them. I'm not saying that happened, but like,
yeah, it could be though.
There could be. And here's the thing that supersedes all of this is boundaries. Like, if this is what your sister's wishes are for this youngster, when he's in your charge, then I would, as hard as it is to see kids walk around with beliefs that are likely not true, and they're dogmatically arrogant about it in some cases, it's so tough. I have that near exact situation with one of my siblings and their kids. They're bright though. They're super bright, but they've been taught these beliefs, and they're not really encouraged to question. And they laugh at evidence if you present it to them that the earth is older than 6,000 years old. And it's so hard personally to deal with that. but that's their wishes. And I'm hopeful that that they will observe me and how I carry myself and how I show curiosity, like genuine curiosity, or changing my mind, or not getting upset if I discover something that's not right, or that I was wrong about something. Like, I'm hopeful that in the long run, when they get old enough and the boundaries that the parents are setting start falling away as they get older, they'll remember you being a kind, patient adult with them. And that might go a long way. And that way you can still maintain the relationship too. Because if you keep pushing, before you know it, you won't be driving that kid around, right? Yeah. I mean, because that, yeah. So it's delicate, very, very delicate.
Yeah. And now I'm actually formally going to be in a position of tutoring and teaching the child how to think about certain things. And so I'm in that tricky situation where not to teach what, and I'm not even sure if, you know, it'd be appropriate to teach the evidence sometimes. But I want to really instill those qualities of asking questions in the way that street epistemology seems to align with.
Here's one thing that just popped in my head. Would it be possible for you to sit down with your sister and the child in the room as you explore what the boundaries are with what you teach and what you don't? Or would she insist on the child being out of the room? Because I think it would be really powerful for the child to be hearing the discussion about what they're allowed to learn or not, and who's exactly setting these boundaries for him.
Yeah, interesting. That's a conversation I was needing to have more in depth with her about what specifically she's envisioning the curriculum looking like and what she wants me to avoid.
And I think
in on that might be valuable.
I think it would be incredibly valuable if he was in on it. Because, yeah, it's the framing is so key, and I think it would be great. Because now I'm wondering, like, the kid may say, "Well, why, mom, can't I learn about that or that type of thing?" And maybe the mom would actually be more open minded to what she was preventing you from teaching if the kid was in the room as you were discussing it.
Excellent.
That's tough.
It sure is. But I'm really grateful for your insights on that. It is very helpful for me. I had another question as well. I'm also interested in peace building efforts, mediation types of things, conflict resolution, and I see some type of a bridge with street epistemology. Although at times I get a little, I get curious about how exactly to apply it. So I have a question that I'll read here that I already posted. In peace building contexts with deeply entrenched beliefs, how can street epistemology facilitate understanding and empathy among opposing sides? Additionally, how can it be integrated into identifying conflict roots and enhancing formal relations or mediation efforts?
I mean, the second part of that question is kind of similar to how I would answer the first, and that is that This is a kind of a new untapped area that we haven't really spent a lot of time, as far as I can tell, in SE circles to facilitate discussions between two opposing sides. And I think we're seeing the smatterings of that, the beginnings of that with Spectrum SE. Like that's why I said there's some potential that could really be good. But is it the right environment where people are on a scale? Because generally we could kind of fight for our positions in those scenarios. And I don't know how much actual reflection is going on. So the facilitated direction of street epistemology is in its like nascent infant stages, as far as I can tell. So I don't really have much advice for you, other than I think it probably would be really good to attempt to use SE in those situations. But how exactly you do it would be really challenging, especially if the two people that you're trying to negotiate with or explore their beliefs simultaneously aren't aware of what you're doing, and they're expecting to defend their position and to show how the other side is wrong, because that's going to probably be their default starting point. So you're going to probably have to do some work at the start to explain what it is you're hoping to do and why you're doing it to get them on board. And they're going to slip back into their old ways. Absolutely. It'll take a very disciplined facilitator to be paying very close attention to what each side is saying and how each side is reacting. So it's not just listening to person A, but it's observing how person B is reacting to what A is saying and vice versa. And that takes a very skilled practitioner. So we need to see more examples of that. I can't really give you any advice, but my sense would be SE could be modified to make that happen.
Excellent. Some of my thoughts on it are that I've told you about nonviolent communication before and how I see a bit of linkage with street epistemology. And I sense that in a situation where you have two sides with conflict with each other, it's each side is having needs that they're representing by expressing themselves. And sometimes it seems a little bit strange. Like, for example, a conflict that I'm close with is that one side thinks that the other side needs to be disciplined, that that's the only way that they'll learn. And
punished?
And punished and like shunning them type of thing for years. And so, you know, I asked them, has this been effective for you? And ultimately, no, but they're attached to the strategy here. And so it's like I'm thinking about how could we explore the quality of that being a good strategy that they're attached to?
Well, if somebody disclosed that was their objective, I think I would express my concern about how problematic it would be if they were attempting to use that with this other person. And then I would ask questions to explore with them how they determine that that's a really good effective way. And what are their goals? Do you think if we did this as you're proposing that we do, do you think it's going to achieve the outcome that you're hoping to achieve? And I think maybe you asked something similar and they said, well, no, it's not going to. Next best way.
That they do it right up until the day that they die, and then they'd find out, like, gosh, you are entrenched.
Boy. I mean, it could be helpful to talk about next best alternatives. Like, let's say, for example, you decided that you just wanted to try something different. And you can always go back to this other thing if it doesn't work out, but what would you start with? And maybe kind of generating sort of a curious mindset of that. But once somebody discloses something like that, where you suspect it's going to be problematic and make things more difficult, you have to stop the facilitation and you have to turn your attention to that individual. Like, you might even take a time out, like, you know, person B, why don't you go grab a cup of coffee? I'm going to have a talk with person A and we're going to explore how they determine that this is a really good effective way to talk to other people about their views. And then you're basically SEing them on their reasoning. And more than likely, they'll probably recognize that it's not probably the best way. You can also do role reversal too. Like, you know, let's say person B comes back from the coffee break, you can say, how would you go about teaching person B to use your approach with you? And it might be interesting for them to verbalize what they want the other person to do to them. They might start to recognize that it's going to be problematic.
Yeah, those are excellent. I'm curious.
A lot of potential, though, with a facilitated SE.
Yeah, is this is this conversation being recorded so I can watch it later?
I'm screen recording it, but I got like the whole screen, which has all sorts of other junk behind it. But I think the audio is being captured by Discord, so you'll be able to listen to it if we put it on the podcast.
Yeah, super. I hope that it is. And those are all my questions. I'm very grateful for your hosting this today and answering my questions. That's very, very sound advice, and some of it's very striking, like the role reversal, and
glad to hear it. All right, Jake, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Anthony.
Okay. Bye. Okay. What do you do for fun? Play, entertainment, hobbies? I don't have any hobbies. Although I've always wanted to raise Siamese fighting fish. Because I love how they breed like the male builds this bubble nest and then he entices the female under there and they lay, she drops the eggs, he fertilizes them and they, I think they both pick up the eggs and stick them in. And then you can get all these wild variations of fish. So I would love to get into that one of these days. I think that that would be so cool, but I just don't have the time. I got the time. I could make the time for that if I wanted to. Then I just start thinking about all the problems that come with that. Well, then you got to change the water. Then you need specialized food. And then the food goes bad and then you're wasting money. And then before you know it, I'm on my computer and doing SE stuff. Oh, there's a note here. If you like, you can stay in the server after this AMA if you want to discuss other things further. That's great advice. There's awesome channels in here. And stick around after this. We've got about 20 more minutes here. Two raised hands. Oh, that's an old comment. Jake, that's your question. I think we talked about regarding about kids being taught to defer to adults as a matter of course makes you wonder how much that plays into continuation of beliefs and religion. Yeah. It's funny too, because I tend to notice that type of outlook where you should be deferential to adults in religious cultures. I tend to see that. But which comes first? I don't know. My guess maybe is the religious stuff comes first. And then the deference to adults, because you don't challenge authority and your parents are the authority figures in your life. And probably also there's not maybe a lot of nuance on like how you could challenge an authority figure in a nice, compassionate, respectful way. It may not dawn on people that you can do that without insulting the older person, yet you can still challenge them. You can teach your kids to be respectful questioners. And that's how we've tried to raise ours. Okay. Is there an SE course for co-parenting? Not yet. Why don't you have hobbies? You know what I, so what this says, also doesn't SE maybe count as a hobby? I would introduce SE as a hobby in my videos. I'm out here asking questions. It's a hobby of mine. And then I started realizing after maybe 4 or 5 years of doing it, I was like, is this really a hobby? It's more like a vocation, but I'm not getting paid for it. So it's not a job. Like what exactly is going on here? What am I doing? So I don't know if I would describe it as a hobby these days. Maybe I'll call it a passion. Oh, sorry. Guijabite. Is there a such thing as too much questioning, examination of belief? To what extent do you think an SE mindset should be applied? I skipped this one because I think I sort of covered that earlier where you could ask so many questions to the point where you alienate your conversation partner and they're no longer interested and now they're just tolerating you as opposed to reflecting on their views. To what extent do you think an SE mindset should be applied? Like the SE mindset, what are those mindsets? Does anyone remember offhand? I think it was curiosity and epistemic humility and collaboration. Those are all just really, really good mindsets to try to remind yourself to be in. And why would you want to have another mindset besides that? I don't know. Like pull up the course, go to module, is it 4, having the right mindset, and refamiliarize yourself with that. There's just great advice in there for those. Okay, I have to skip the hobby question. Oh, we're at the bottom, I think. Okay, maybe we're caught up. All right. Sorry. Okay, maybe this is the last one then, which is fine with me. Sorry if this has been answered. It's been bouncing in and out while working. Is SE most effective one-on-one versus attempted group interactions / dynamics a la SSE? Okay, I'm going to just narrow that down. Like, yeah, is SE more effective one-on-one or in a group interaction? I don't know. My sense would be that you're going to have a much more profound conversation and much more effective results if it's a one-on-one conversation where your conversation partner feels psychologically safe and they trust you and you're picking up on their cues and you're moving at a pace that they're comfortable with. And once you introduce somebody else into that mix, then it throws it off. And I even warn people in my videos, like, try not to let the other person's questions influence yours. How the heck do you account for that? So I think a lot of times people will hold back on what they really want to say because there's somebody else in the room who maybe believes the same thing, or they've had arguments about it or something like that. So my sense is that one-on-one is optimal, but I have seen some instances. I think there's a video on Nathan Ferguson's channel. He's an abstract activist, and he was conducting the SE survey, which is essentially a distillation of the types of questions on a meta level that we ask in SE. And he was facilitating a talk with maybe five or six people in the room. And there was a couple in there, a man and a woman. And the question was about truth, if they thought truth was objective or subjective. And one of them thought it was objective and the other one was insisting that it was subjective. And you could just see, like, the woman was like pulling away from the guy, like, what do you believe? And I really felt for the person who seemed like the outsider, because now there's not just his girlfriend or whatever looking at him strangely, but maybe other people who didn't agree with him. And how do you help a person reflect on their own reasoning when you have that dynamic? So it's very, very challenging. So that's why I would lean more towards one-on-one if you can. Okay. Wow. That was a lot of fun. I've got a few links here I wanted to drop, but before I go, I think I shared this one earlier. This is the link to the talk that I'm giving on Saturday to a whole bunch of teachers who will be teaching philosophy concepts, and I'll be teaching street epistemology to them and giving all these teachers some tools to teach their kids things to look for to become better critical thinkers and more careful reasoners and more responsible claimants. And then we also are testing module 7 of the course. It's called Navigating Beliefs. And module 7 is the identifying and clarifying claims. And on the 23rd and 24th, we're going to have a Zoom meeting. We have 4 sessions, two on Saturday, two on Sunday, where we're going to review. We'll have people in a room who have reviewed that module to give us feedback. So it's not too late to make a request, I don't think. You could probably still do it. Hopefully David will see your email and give you the information you need to see the course, and you can read it and give us your feedback. And then here's the link. Well, this is not a link, but it's more a date and time. That's the date and time of the next SEI town hall. And then Melanie Tracy King just released an interview that I did with her on her channel. I think the audio is a little goofed up. So if we can't figure that out, I might just, upload it to my own channel with her permission. I need to talk with her about it, but you can take a look at that video there. I'm noticing one more question just sneaked in here right at the end, and it's from Jake. Are there any specific logistical considerations I should keep in mind when planning to spend several hours doing street epistemology in a public park? Module 5 of the course is called Preparing to Do Street Epistemology. And while it's not written specifically for doing outdoor SE, there's a lot of great advice that that applies to doing outdoor SE, like paying attention to how you're feeling personally. And do you have enough time? Are you in a good mindset to conduct these types of talks? So module 5, hey, let me drop the link to the course. Why don't I do that? Okay, cool. That was a blast. Thank you everyone for showing up. That was really fantastic to get your thoughts. If I had to title this AMA, I would say something like Using Street Epistemology for Kids or something along those lines, because it seemed like that was kind of a somewhat common theme. So feel free to stick around. Yeah, there's lots of different channels here. Maybe Yang, you can post the link to, if that's allowed, you can post the link to your Compassionate Epistemology one. But that's it for me. Thank you all for showing up, and I usually wait like a couple months and then I just do another one. And as long as I get 20 or 30 people showing up or more, I'll just keep doing these because it seems like there's interest. All right, I am off. Thanks, everybody.
The Street Epistemology Podcast is a production of Street Epistemology International. The views, guests, and topics expressed here, or not expressed here, do not necessarily represent those of the organization.